podcast this week, we turn on the dash cam and talk to the director and stars of the brand new British horror, Rob Savage, Annie Hardy, and Umarjada Patel. All that and more on the movie podcast. I can't imagine that the Queen could possibly have a better night than that time she attended a function in the States and ended up with Lieutenant Frank Drebin lying on top of her. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, we're in the grey, depressing pod booth, as per usual. But this week, we have no Helen O'Hara. Oh no. She has decided to take some... Hey, Siri. Hey, Siri. What is holiday? Siri's gone on holiday as well. Siri's just not responding to that. Siri cannot even comprehend the mere concept of a holiday, and nor can I. Helen O'Hara is away, but I'm joined by my two colleagues of such lethal cunning this week. Great big fucking nerd, James Dyer, is here.
Hello there.
Hello there. Oh, wait, we've just done that one.
That's right.
Damn it. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Christopher. Yes.
Good.
Yes.
It's been a bit of a day. Obviously, this is the only day we're in the office this week because Her Madge has condensed the week. So we are pressed for time.
We are pressed for time.
So we're
going
to do this particular podcast in a record time.
Record time. And you've recorded, was it your show?
My little fan show. Pilot, yes. I've done Pilot. We've done Obi-Wan. This is my third pod in a row. I'm slightly exhausted.
Yeah.
Slightly delirious.
Yeah, but it'll be fine.
Yeah. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. You were a valuable contributor to the Obi-Wan Kenobi podcast. So I expect you'll be just some sort of puddle by the end of this. You'll be totally fine. But we're also joined by someone doing their second podcast in a row. Look at him. He's ready for more. It is, of course, the best dressed golfing film journalist.
I was
going to say,
he's wearing a
lovely sort of Pringle Nick. Yeah, Freddie, you got a touch of the Faldos today with his lovely sweater. Maybe we'll take a picture of it and post it on socials. It is, of course, Amon Warman. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. This is actually the debut, the coming out party of this top today.
It should go back in.
Oh! Yeah.
No, it's lovely. It's lovely. Yeah. You're going to play around with Tarby later on?
I was talking to you about this golf thing earlier. I'm probably like a golfer today. Like, I've never done any actual proper golfing. I know that you've done a lot with your wife recently.
Well, I have. Easy.
That's very personal.
It is, isn't it? Yes, my wife and I have become swingers of late. We do love a bit of golf. And we play golf as well.
Yeah. Holding mum.
James now. Oh, it's a fair way from here until the end of the podcast.
I've run out of golf terminology. I've got nothing.
Yeah, thank God. Otherwise, it's like an albatross around
my neck.
There we go. Anyway, yes, Amon is looking sharp and slick.
Yeah.
And here we are on the week that Helen is away, and we're talking about Men, which is a film about toxic masculinity. And we have, frankly, this is a big old sausage fest. So I apologize.
Yeah. And we all look like Rory Kinnear, so that's interesting.
We will be talking about Men later on in the show, but much later on in the show. Now it is actually time to delve deep into this week's listener question, which you guys don't know what it is, mainly because I haven't actually chosen one yet. I did a panic this morning. I was on the train back from Leeds. Why was I in Leeds? Well, I was on visiting a set of a movie, if you must know, with your incessant questionings, Amon Warman. I said, any questions for the teams to tackle? Because we're away, because of Queen of Palooza. If you don't know what's happening, if you're an overseas listener and you're thinking, what the hell's going on here? So the Queen, it's her Platinum Jubilee this week, which is 70 years atop the throne. And the country's losing its mind over this. The upside of this is that we get 2 days off. We get a bank holiday and an extra bank holiday. And they have been brought together in the same week to give people what they think is ostensibly a 4-day weekend. Unfortunately, I've seen my schedule. I am busy. I'm working most of tomorrow for a start. I'm hoping to take Friday off. That would be nice. That would be really, really nice. But we'll see how it goes. But anyway, because of that, that's why we're here recording this podcast early. And so I said, we're recording this week's podcast today because of Queen of Palooza. Any questions for the team to tackle? So the first question is from @Sirijo_UK, but just scrolling through here, pretty much loads of people have asked this, including Louise Burr, Izzy Paul Spies, and various other people have basically asked the best examples of royalty, not just British, in movies.
Obviously, we have to go with Black Panther here, T'Challa.
There he goes. Amazing King. Regular as clockwork.
Oh, I mean, Amon, he's no King Ralph, and I think we can all agree.
We can agree. But T'Challa, I'd also say Coming to America has awesome black royalty in that film as well. So those would be the two that immediately come to mind.
Oh, Coming to America would have been my number one without a shadow of a doubt. Without a shadow of a doubt.
Wait, I remind you that Princess Leia Organa
I knew you were going to say that. I mean, if we're getting into it, Duke Leto Atreides obviously is a duke, but I'm saying royalty, you know, so.
Is it? I guess it is royalty, isn't it? Yeah. Okay.
As much as I love Thor as a character, he's not a very good prince or king in the MCU.
Cast you out!
Starts up a war, you know, has Asgard be destroyed.
Oh, he's a brat.
He's not the greatest. So King Ralph, James said. Is there any fondness for that movie? King Ralph, in which case people don't know what that is. In case people don't know what it is the movie in which John Goodman is made the King of England after the entire royal family are electrocuted. It's really dark.
I rewatched
just the opening of King Ralph a couple of years ago. My wife and I we'd stopped playing golf for the afternoon, obviously, and we were stumbling around just looking for stuff to watch, and King Ralph was on TV, and was like rewatching it. It's like everybody dies and is played for comedy, and it's so really tonally bizarre and fucked up. And then John Goodman, who of course is this uncouth brash American who loves rock and roll and all the stuff that the Brits don't like, becomes the king, and you know, it's a classic rags to riches storyline. It's not terribly good, but it's but he's a good example of a king, I would say.
Solid.
Who else can I pick from a royalty point of view?
Come
the
on,
Alien Jeff. Queen. Does that count?
Alien Queen. There's one right there.
Oh, go on.
Aragorn, son of Arathorn.
He is Isildur's heir.
He is.
Yes.
Yeah, I must concede. Yeah. Yes,
Aragorn,
he made a good point
son
there.
Of Arathorn. Yes.
The third movie is literally titled The Return of the King.
I know. I mean, I see what you're saying.
Like Lord of the Rings, right?
I Lord of the Rings, but I'm a big Strider fan. Like when he's like Dunedain, like when he's got Strider, it. When he's, you know, and whatever 15 other names he's got, I like him. When he sort of scrubs up as the king, no.
Really?
No.
He has that awesome scene at the Black Gate with that awesome speech.
Does he though?
Yes. What are you talking about?
Depends on what edition you're watching. Well, I suppose that's true. How much of it is in? Because the lines blur. How much of that scene at the Black Gate is in the theatrical cut?
It's been a long time since I've seen the return.
Because I only watched the extended. But yeah. I'm like, I know the mouth of Sauron is only in the extended, but does the Black Gate scene still feature?
I think that entire speech still features in the theatrical edition. Okay. The mouth of Sauron, as you say, is in the extended edition.
Poor Bruce.
Yeah. The "This day we fight!" That's in the theatrical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. No, that's not a bad shout. I'll give you that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Who else? Kings, queens...
Oh my gosh!
The king and queen are in, lest we forget, the Downton Abbey movie. So, you know.
Yes, they are.
I can't believe I've waited this long to say this. I feel bad myself. Mufasa!
Mufasa!
The Lion King!
Yeah, he is.
The best animated movie, the best Disney animated movie of all time, still for me. I know.
Best animated movie of all time is
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I have a very large soft spot for The Lion King, the original animated Lion King.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah,
loved it.
And Mufasa, still to this day, when Mufasa dies, it doesn't feel good. I don't like watching.
No, it doesn't feel good. It's not supposed to feel good. If it felt good, you'd be a sociopath. So.
I don't like watching it.
It's not a cheerable moment.
It's not played for lols, like generally.
Yeah. I don't think he enjoys it either, in fairness.
It just makes me feel very sad, is all. Yeah, but yeah, Mufasa is a fantastic... I'm going to stop saying it now. But he is a fantastic king. And I love the relationship that he has with Simba all the way through. Mm-hmm. Remember. And then when he ascends to... Oh, The Lion King is so good. I love that movie.
What about depictions of our beloved royal family in the movies? the movies. Anything that springs to mind apart from your obvious ones? Helen Mirren as the Queen in, let me Google it, Le Queen, or Colin Firth as the King George V in The King's Speech.
I do have a soft spot for The King's Speech. I know that it won Best
Picture. It's a lot of shit, doesn't it? Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah, me too.
So shoot me,
guys. Maybe not to the tune of like Best Picture winner, but I do like the movie.
Most films that win Best Picture aren't deserving of winning Best Picture, but it's a pretty good film.
Yeah.
I think.
Agreed.
All right, then. Agree to agree. Let's move on, shall we? What about things like Spencer? And what about the numerous depictions of Princess Diana? Are we fans of any of those? Have they just not cracked that particular nut yet?
No love for it.
No
Spencer,
love.
Spencer, no. The Queen. No, I mean, they're fine.
She didn't even get the voice right. Ooh.
I thought Kristen Stewart.
Wow. What?
I thought Kristen Stewart was good in the role. The film, I didn't have a lot of time.
A lot of head acting. A lot of head tilt acting. It was good.
Mm. Yeah. The film, not so much. Although the score by Johnny Greenwood is fantastic. What? It's true. But yeah. I do you watch The Crown? I don't.
I do not get down with The Crown, no.
Yeah.
Heavy is the remote control that links to The Crown or something. I don't know. I hadn't thought that through. But anyway, let's just go with it. I'm going to say, and I've already said it, and I say The Naked Gun constantly, The Naked Gun, Top Secret, Evil Dead 2, Event Horizon, those are my four revolving answers that apply to pretty much any question we get asked in the podcast. But I'm going to say it's the best depiction of the Queen on the big screen.
Is it Event Horizon? Did I miss that scene?
No, not Event Horizon, but you know, but of those four, the one that's applicable in this case, Jimbo, is The Naked Gun, which is entirely based around an attempt to kill the Queen. I must kill the Queen at the baseball game we talked about in depth.
Enrico
Palazzo!
Ago.
Yes. Yay, it's Enrico Palazzo! All that stuff. That's all based around the attempt to kill the Queen at the baseball game in LA. And Lieutenant Sergeant Frank Drebin, I love that joke, which implies a sergeant is his first name, but anyway, is assigned to kill her. And not to kill her, to protect her. And, you know, winds up in the very first big soiree, accidentally mistaking her for a terrorist and bundling over. It's much funnier in the film, believe me. But then, you know, he lands on top of her in a very sexually suggestive position. Tons of fun. She's played in that movie by Jeanette Charles, who was certainly, I'm not sure if she still is, was certainly the leading Queen Elizabeth II impersonator, and played her in a number of movies, if I'm right in thinking, over the years. And she's very good in that movie. She gets a lot of stuff to do. Jeanette Charles, still alive. Astonishingly, she is still alive. She's 94.
Wow.
That's a good innings.
That is a very good innings. Jeanette Charles is a British retired actress who often portrayed Queen Elizabeth II due to her resemblance to the monarch, says my good old pal, Wikipedia. And she was in all sorts of stuff. She was in National Lampoon's European Vacation as the Queen. She was in The Parent Trap as the Queen. And she was in Austin Powers in Goldmember as the Queen. So there you go. That's just four of the films that Jeanette Charles appeared in. Not to be confused with Jeanette Goldstein, who played, of course, Vasquez in Aliens, which has the best movie queen.
That's right.
Another great movie king, Leonidas in 300.
Dash podcast!
That is a good one.
It is a good one.
That is a good one.
Yeah.
Spartans, what is your profession?
I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. Your profession is Aru. Are they French?
You see, my friend, I have brought more soldiers than you. Great line.
Then we will podcast in the shade.
We probably will when the lights turn off in a second.
That's absolutely true.
We probably will, yeah. Queen Amidala, someone suggested Queen Amidala. Of course, we said Princess Leia, but yeah, everyone loves Queen Amidala.
I still have issues with the fact that she's a democratically elected monarch. It's weird.
Anyway, here we go. Let me see. I'm going to throw one more question at you guys real quick. Filippo81, how easy/difficult is it for a film franchise to divorce itself from a toxic fandom, and why does the toxic fandom continue to consume output? It obviously hates. Now, this is something we discussed at length, actually, on that most recent Obi-Wan Kenobi spoiler special. But for people who didn't, and perhaps aren't entirely sure what this is about, this is a direct reference to something that emerged this week post-Star Wars Celebration, which is that Moses Ingram, the actress who plays the third sister slash Reva on Obi-Wan Kenobi, which of course is on Disney Plus right now, this week revealed that she's been inundated with vile, disgusting, abhorrent, racist messages and DMs on Instagram from people who purport to be Star Wars fans, but who are anything but. Moses Ingram is a person of color who plays effectively among the first prominent black woman in live-action Star Wars. And sadly, she has gone down the road of Kelly Marie Tran before her and John Boyega before her, and just been targeted by these absolute rancid fucking dickheads. It's disgusting to see. What was good to see this week is that she's not standing for this. She's highlighting this, and that Star Wars as an entity, which previously got criticized, I think quite correctly, for kind of standing by and letting this sort of shit happen to Kelly Marie Tran in particular after The Last Jedi, issued a very, very unequivocal statement denouncing and decrying this, saying something like there's 20 million sentient species in the Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. Why would you choose to be, don't choose to be a racist? Why would you choose to be a racist? That sort of thing. But awful.
Yeah, awful is the word. It really angers me on so many levels. You know, this is Moses Ingram, who's having a breakout few years. I mean, I think she only sort of really started acting in roles in 2018. And already she's had stuff like The Queen's Gambit and now this
Ambulance
show.
As well.
She's an ambulance. You know, she's having a breakout few months. And this should be the highlight of that. You're joining Star Wars, one of the biggest franchises in the world. As you say, the first prominent black woman to really sort of have a role in this universe. She should be on cloud nine right now, but instead she's having to deal with this nonsense, which really, really irritates me. As regards to the question, how does one divorce itself from that? It's very, very tricky, because in the world of the internet, anybody's going to have the opportunity to have a voice and to make their opinions known, no matter how stupid they are. So, you know, and it's not just Star Wars in that regard. We've had it in DC stuff. We've had it in MCU. Marvel stuff. What we can do, and as you say, what Star Wars have done as an entity, is denounce it as loudly and as often as possible. That's not something which we've previously seen from Star Wars. I'm glad that we are now seeing that. It means a lot to have them come out and say that, and for not just us to see, but for Moses Ingram, I'm sure, to know that people have her back in a big way, I think is great. But unfortunately, this has become the norm. This has become expected. This is, none of this that's happened with Moses Ingram, none of it which will happen in the future, will be surprising. And it makes me so upset to say that. I don't know how we fully to divorce ourselves from it. I'm not sure it's possible at this stage. But to have people denounce it loudly and often, I think is one of the ways to go.
It's an unfortunate symptom of well, not just fandom as a whole, but just people. Because you say, like, fandom is fandom and racists are racists, and when racists are in fandom, they're just going to be racist, because people are trying to sort of like make sense of it. Like, oh, there's no logic to it. People are complaining about race in a universe with aliens. It's got nothing to do with logic. It's just that some people are racist. And that is sad.
Yep, absolutely. I think the way ahead to divorce yourself from this sort of thing as a fan base, do exactly what Star Wars and Lucasfilm and Disney have done in this case, which is to make a statement denouncing it, and also to show the right way through the products that you make.
Right. I mean, on the spoiler special, Ben Travis, who was just at Star Wars Celebration, spoke of the love that he felt and that Hayden Christensen in particular felt while being at Celebration, and how that was so awesome to see given the reaction to the prequels. And yeah, I would love to be in an environment like that. Maybe when Celebration comes to London next year, as it's going to do, I can get myself down to that, because that is the environment that I love to be in. And that's the environment that I find myself in at numerous occasions, and whether it be live podcasts, or whether it be even when we go and see a big multimedia screening, there's that love for what we're about to see and that excitement for what we're about to see. And that is the way to express your fandom. I mean, when it's done right, fandom is a beautiful thing, and I love being involved in it.
And there's something worth pointing out there. Like, people are saying, oh, Star Wars fandom is toxic and whatnot. Like, and like, I've never found that to be the case in general. I've been to Celebration a bunch of times, and it is such a warm, inclusive, just loving, just hugely positive place full of people who are really passionate and open. And the love that people like Kelly Marie Tran have had at those events is real. And I think there, of course, are toxic parts of fandom, but they're not the kind of people who are at Celebration. It's the kind of people who are sitting in their basements on the internet being trolls. And it's not unique to Star Wars. God knows DC, one of its biggest problems is they have a particularly malignant corner of internet fandom, which is unfortunate. But, you know, there are bad corners of every fandom. It's an unfortunate thing, but it does tend to be, you know, as you say, it's the internet, it's anonymity, it's that kind of shroud of secrecy that lets people lash out at people.
And Chris, you were just at MCM Comic Con a few days ago, right?
I was, yeah, that's absolutely right. And again, it's exactly the same thing. You know, it's the reason why I hope to get back to, no disrespect intended, proper Comic-Con, the one in San Diego, at some point, because it's just extraordinary being there at the XL, even just for a few hours, and even if you're largely confined to backstage, when you do get to wander around and you see the people, and it just the acceptance and the togetherness and the love that's on display, and the cosplay is astonishing. And it's, you know, when you go to these things, and especially now, it's becoming more and more apparent to me that there's stuff that I'm just not aware of on a sort of geek cultural level. There's a lot of anime cosplay out there that just completely goes over my head, but it's so good to be at these places where it's such a safe space and there is no judgment and you can be absolutely yourself. And I kind of feel envious of a lot of these people, and I've thought this ever since I went to my first Comic-Con back in 2003, because yes folks, I am that fucking old. I go to these things cosplaying as an increasingly overweight journalist. But, you know, one day I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it, like, actually properly embrace it and go there and do the cosplay, because some of it's just staggering. But it's such a great place. And Star Wars Celebration is such a great event to go to. And, I would have loved to have been there to see things like the Hayden Christensen, the acceptance that, you know, and the love that is now going his way. And, you know, I talk about this in the spoiler specials about how Attack of the Clones has been rehabilitated. Not entirely by me. I'm still not at 5 stars yet. But, you know, it is great to see it kind of swinging around again. And Celebration was kind of responsible for quite a bit of news that popped out last week, towards the end of last week. Lucasfilm obviously have a big, big presence, as you might expect, at a Star Wars event. And part of Lucasfilm's slate is Indiana Jones 5. And we got the first image from Indiana Jones 5 last week. And it didn't really tell us a lot, in that it was an image of Indiana Jones played by Harrison Ford, and he was shrouded in shadow. But it also maybe told us something, or suggested something, because the fact that we didn't see his face, I think, is very interesting. There are lots of rumors about this movie. There are rumors that it might involve time travel. There are rumors that it might involve a de-aged Indiana Jones, at least for a significant part of it. And I'm wondering if the fact that we didn't see his face might be because they're still working on it.
This is the first time hearing of this. This is very interesting.
Now, there are rumors. There's nothing concrete, but I'm just saying there are rumors, and the fact that this didn't explicitly go, here is 80-something, he's 80, he's 80 now, isn't he? Harrison Ford, he's just turned 80, or he's about to turn 80, or 107, whatever he is. You know, here is Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. In fact, it didn't do that. It means that there's ground for speculation there, I think.
Yeah, perhaps. If there is a de-aged element to it, I hope that it's not for the bulk of it. Because I feel like part of the joy of this particular Indiana Jones film is a Harrison Ford's last ride. It would be a shame if Harrison Ford's last ride as this character is him being de-aged for a significant part of it, I think.
Yeah, also you'll have the problem that you have with The Irishman, where someone looks young but they still move like an old man.
Yes.
And it's very disconcerting.
Oh, yes it is.
Especially in a film like this, which is, let's be honest, going to be slightly more physical than The Irishman.
Yeah.
Unless he literally paints houses.
I think maybe he does. But if they did go down that road, you could easily have a body double doing that sort of stuff.
But then at what point then do you just not need Harrison Ford? And it's just, you're going full face mapping and, you know?
Well, listen, there's all speculation, but I'm just saying that to me it was interesting that the poster didn't show his face. That's all I'm saying. And let's not take any of that as gospel.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, it's interesting. And there was lots of stuff that came out of Celebration as well. You know, revelations that the first season of Andor is going to be 12 episodes long.
Either or.
It's going to be 12 episodes long, for example. There was lots of talk about Mandalorian season three.
And Andor, 12 episodes long, and they're doing a second season.
Second season.
And it's just like, that's 24 episodes of Andor, which, to be honest, feels like a threat.
Oh, come on.
Yeah,
did you not like Rogue One?
Oh, no, I think Andor feels like Rogue One with all the good characters removed. That's my worry about it. But, you know, we'll see.
You didn't like Diego Luna in Rogue One?
I would say Andor is maybe the, if certainly not one of the most forgettable characters in all of Star Wars. Yeah, I'm not a fan.
I think one of the issues with Rogue One, which is a good, solid Star Wars movie, is that its two leads are less memorable than the supporting cast.
Yeah, like K2SO, I got loads of time for him. Yeah. Like, I thought Alan Tudyk was really funny in that, you know.
Donnie Yen.
Yeah.
Like, I'm on with the Force and the Force.
100%. But I felt Andor as a character was super bland.
Well, maybe this will help unbland it.
Precisely.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe they will make it work. You probably covered this on the Pilot TV podcast, Jimbo, but Jodie Foster is going to star in True Detective season 4.
We did mention it. It's exciting times. It makes me almost consider watching True Detective again, so that's good.
But not quite.
No, I will. I will 100% watch this one. Obviously, season one was amazing. Season two was lamentable. Season three was an improvement, but I still didn't watch all of it. But luckily, I can start fresh with this because it's an anthology, so it's all good.
No, yeah, I need to catch up with that. Season two was the Mahershala Ali one.
It was, yeah. And he was really good in it.
Mm. Mahershala Ali always brings it.
True.
Blade, man.
Blazer.
Yeah, Blazer.
Blazer. Blazer.
Yeah. Blazer. I accept full responsibility for that.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
Rachel Zegler,
yeah,
has been cast in.
Amon slows down as he looks up the name of the character.
Let's be honest,
Lucy Gray Baird.
It was right on the tip of my tongue, yeah. James. Okay,
gosh. The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. It's the Hunger Games prequel.
Initially, the Hunger Games prequel, I just kind of shrugged at it and didn't think it was. I mean, no film was necessary, but I think the Hunger Games prequel, I was like, we're really going back to this again. But I'm such a big fan of Rachel Zegler, incredible in West Side Story, already on a ridiculous career trajectory, and she's only, what, like 20 years old? It's insane. But yeah, her talent being attached to this has me infinitely more interested than I was.
Yes, yeah. You didn't have my curiosity. Now you have some of my attention.
Yeah. Something like that.
She was by far the least tedious thing in West Side Story, so I'm going for this.
Yeah. Helen's on here. Helen's on an actual holiday. But
she can hear me. I can hear her shouting.
You know that scene in Snatch where Dennis Farina travels from America to England and it's all done in a series of really quick... Yeah, that's Helen right now. She's going to come through that door in any second. You say one more... fucking word about West Side Story. I'll
she's
on
now. You see, she's going like, I feel something terrible has happened. Like, millions of voices cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced.
And a million jets were suddenly silenced.
Yeah. I'm just such a big fan of hers. Obviously, we got to speak to her for Empire 500, which was fantastic. I'm now intrigued. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Actually not a lot of news this week.
Well, especially not given when this podcast is going out
this
and when
is
we're
true.
Recording it.
We are recording it on Sunday morning. No, we're recording it Wednesday afternoon. And there's probably going to be tons of news happening between now and Friday. But if there is, we're not really going to be in a position to do much about it. Yeah. It's pretty much like the end of the thing. You know, we're sitting here freezing to death.
Yeah.
And if either of us do have any surprises for each other, I'm not sure any of us are in any condition to do anything about it. Fair. So that's pretty much where we are. We should talk as well about how brilliantly Top Gun Maverick did at the box office.
Yeah.
Did make some money. Wow. Good. So we're coming down then.
We should talk about it.
It made loads of money, which is lovely. But also, I think, you know, necessary, because I think one of the big takeaways from that is not just that it's a brilliant film, which it is, but it's that it is a specifically cinematic experience. It's the kind of thing where, you know, a significant portion of that film's impact will be lost on the small screen. Like, you've got to see it in a cinema. Like, if you see no other film, apart from Dune Part 2, but then that's not out this year, so if you can go into forward in time and watch Dune Part 2, then do that. But if you watch nothing else this year, you know, watch this and Avatar The Way of Water in cinemas.
Absolutely right in terms of the Top Gun Maverick watching the cinema bit. The other stuff, you know, your mileage may vary. But yeah, now I absolutely love this film and I completely agree. This was worth delaying, just check my notes, 370 times. Yeah, they delayed it and delayed it and delayed it, but it was absolutely worth it because seeing this film in IMAX for the first time as it was meant to be seen was something else. Like one of the most euphoric, punch the air cinema experiences that I've had in recent times. It was that good. So yeah, I'm glad that people are going to the cinema in droves and experiencing exactly that.
I think the real test is going to be this weekend, see whether it has legs. I think it will have legs. I think it's going to have very impressive legs, which for a movie about planes is no mean feat. But it made something like $151 million in the States over the four-day weekend. It was the Memorial Day weekend, which is kind of traditionally the launch of the summer blockbuster season in the States. And that is by far the biggest opening of Tom Cruise's career, which is kind of weird because he is, I would say, the biggest movie star on the planet and has been for 36 years, essentially, since the first Top Gun. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there are movie stars in that time who have been bigger than Tom Cruise. You know, obviously, your Will Smiths, your Leonardo DiCaprio's, your Tom Hanks's, people like that. But in terms of sheer consistency, Cruise is pretty much unchallenged, I would say. And yet, he's never had a billion-dollar grosser. He's never had a $100 million opening weekend until now. It's been really interesting. He's never really had that big, powerful box office smash. Like the biggest film he'd had previously to this was Mission Impossible Fallout. And I think if this does well, holds well, it'll do well. And I think Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is going to probably even do better than this when it opens next year. But Top Gun Maverick seems to have really tapped into a couple of things. One, a desire for people to get back in the cinema to see something that is must see, which we saw worked with Spider-Man No Way Home, which we saw worked to an extent with Dune Part 1. And No Time to Die, to an extent, you know, and where I think the confidence was coming back tentatively. Now I think it's back. I think we're kind of back to where we were pre-pandemic in terms of people's willingness to go to the cinema. I think there's obviously the reviews have been astonishing for this thing, so people want to see it. It's been hailed as a cinematic experience. You have to go and see it. And three, there's the nostalgia factor. I've seen loads of reports on Twitter of people who love the first Top Gun, who are now taking their kids and grown men hugging each other and crying at certain points during the movie. It feels to me that this could be a big one going forward, which leads me to ask, and I posted this on Twitter the other day, that I feel that this might be, I don't know, it's not going to win, but I feel that this might be this year's Mad Max Fury Road and take a Best Picture nomination.
Ooh, I'm not sure about that.
I'm with them on.
Yeah, as much as I love it. Honestly, the Best Picture nomination that I'm pulling for is Everything Everywhere All at Once. And it should win right now.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah,
I'm saying that should be nominated too.
Yeah, no.
I reckon that actually has probably more of a chance.
But. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't obviously hate it if it did. I don't see it.
I think it will. I think it'll get nominated as a big comeback story, B, a big success story, C, a really, really great example of just doing something like this as practically as you possibly can. I mean, you know, it was an astonishing achievement from a practical point of view. And I think that, you know, it's a great piece of action filmmaking. I think if it does, if it sticks around, I think it might get nominated. I'm not saying it'll win. It won't win. But I'm just saying. Yeah.
We had a trailer this week.
Pinocchio.
Exactly right.
Okay. What was it like? I didn't watch it.
It was okay.
All right, brilliant.
Yeah. Nah,
thanks for bringing it up.
the good thing about this Pinocchio, I guess, for them is that they have a few months on...
Remember, I know of your line.
What?
Because your nose will grow. It's a Pinocchio joke.
I get it now. Pinocchio had a trailer.
Yes.
This week. And the good thing about it is that this movie has a few months on the Guillermo del Toro Pinocchio, the stop motion Pinocchio, which is releasing on Netflix around Christmas time. And this is the Robert Zemeckis, Tom Hanks version. And yeah, Tom Hanks is on a bit of a roll right now. He's obviously just starred in Elvis, which we'll be talking about
very much. In
a couple weeks. But yeah, looks like he's going to make a really cool Geppetto. I liked some of the visuals in this trailer as well. I am intrigued.
All right. Okay. Looking forward to that.
The cast is really solid as well. You got Cynthia.
I'm sure
Erivo.
They are. One of them's made of wood.
You got Cynthia Erivo, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Keegan-Michael Key, Luke Evans. All good people. I like these people.
Bloody Luke Evans.
Bloody Luke Evans.
Ruddy bloody Luke Evans. Exciting stuff. Pinocchio coming soon.
Yeah.
All right, we should finish off with some very, very sad news, which broke last week because we recorded last week's podcast early again. And then on the Thursday came the very, very sad news that the great Ray Liotta had passed away at the age of 67. And the reason we recorded last week's podcast early was we were really up against it schedule-wise. We looked at our schedules. We were trying desperate to make it work. We could find time to get back into the pod booth to talk about Ray Liotta and talk about some other news stories that had broken in the interim. And honestly, we just didn't have the time. So if you heard last week's podcast, I said we would push it to this week to talk about Ray Liotta and give him the send-off that, frankly, he deserves, because his was an incredible career filled with some amazing, indelible performances. 67 is absolutely no age. Passed away in his sleep. Just a great, great actor.
Yeah. Now, some of the films on his filmography are just incredible. Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner, obviously, but Goodfellas is the one that's probably his most memorable role. Think about how much charm he puts into that one, well, the nuance as well. It's one of those roles where you can rewatch it endlessly and find something new. He's a one of one actor. I can't wait to revisit I can't wait to revisit more of his work in the wake of his passing.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, Copland, so many things that he's been. He could do that kind of like crazed manic thing so brilliantly. And he was really intimidating in some of these roles as well.
Mm-hmm.
Genuinely great actor. You know, I mean, not all of the films he were in great, like Smoke and Aces. Obviously, he is flawed. I love his performance.
I've got time for that film.
Whoa.
I've got time for that film.
Okay. Fair enough. You know, the man was in Date Night. Like, he's done some great stuff.
Hang on, you come up to Smoke and Aces and then you hold up Date Night.
Okay. Hey, Date Night is a fucking classic. Smoke and Aces, not so much.
Range that he has as well. You've got the many saints of Newark, which he has, but then you also have stuff like Marriage Story as well.
Mm. Well, if you're talking about the many saints of Newark, which I actually think was the last time I saw him on
definitely,
the big screen,
because
you and I saw it together, and he plays twin roles in that, which I didn't know. Did you know that before
not
we went into
in,
it?
No.
Yeah. So he plays twin roles in that, and he's really good, and both of them is like, you know, they're completely antithetical.
Hollywood Dick and then his brother.
Yeah, who's very chilled and very thin, and Hollywood Dick is not that. So he's the father of Dickie Moltisanti in that. He's so good, and he was having this bit of a renaissance, a renaissance, if you will. And he was just, he was a really intense actor, but he had a good sense of humor. I never met him, but I know the people who have spoken to him who said that he was a really sharp, straight ahead dude, you know, who called it like he saw it, had a good sense of humor about himself and his work. But you look at that filmography and it's incredible. I don't know whether you guys have seen Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, which is just an amazing, amazing movie. And he kind of exploded onto the scene in that as one of the most terrifying bad guys you will ever see. You know, Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith, and he plays Melanie Griffith's wild, psychotic ex. And that really put him on the map. And, you know, then he plays Field of Dreams and he's, again, the antithesis of that. And he's actually kind of, you know, there's a little twinkle to the eye in that one that, you know, maybe shows that he's, you know, he could be a bad'un, but, you know, or he could have naughty tendencies, shall we say. But he's playing very much an all-American icon in that, albeit a sort of figment of someone's imagination or a ghost, if you will. But that's fine. Copland, he is great in Copland. I love that movie so much. Mm-hmm. It is 25 years old this year. You know, one of Stallone's best performances, one of Liotta's best performances as well in many, many ways. He is the I wouldn't say the heart of that movie, because Stallone's the heart of that movie, but he's the conscience of that movie in a weird way. There are great movies littered all the way through his career. Killing Them Softly is a fantastic film, and he's great in it. Also, Date Night, the aforementioned Date Night, but it all comes back to Goodfellas. It all comes back to Henry Hill. And someone made a really good point the other day when they were eulogizing Ray Liotta on Twitter, which is, you know, yeah, the obvious stuff about that movie, which is you have these incredible performances of Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Paul Sorvino, and the cast is stacked in that thing. And yet he holds his own. Not just holds his own, he is dynamite in that. And he is so utterly authentic and sparky and charming, but also menacing. And there's just something about the performance that just, you can't take your eyes off him, even when the guy who wins the Oscar for playing the famous jack-in-the-box psychopath, you know, Joe Pesci, even when he's on screen. If you're watching the, Funny How scene, watch Ray Liotta in that scene, because he's mesmerizing in that scene as well.
Oh, the way he pulls off that kind of like nervous laughter, clearly shitting himself, and the way he does these emotional contortions in his face just as that scene progresses. And then that perfect sort of grace note to it, which is the, oh, it's all a joke, and he's laughing, and then his laugh just kind of slightly tails off in that kind of like, this is not fucking funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
So good.
He's so good. And, you know, there's so much in that movie that's iconic. As far back as I could remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. The end where he gets up and addresses the camera. It's so fucking great. The performance is amazing. The sweaty paranoia of Henry Hill's coke-fueled nightmare, which is just tremendous. But as someone pointed out on Twitter, the thing I wanted to talk about was the fact that performance is so filled with voiceover. It is absolutely, you know, it breaks every rule in the book, everything you're told not to do as a budding screenwriter, which is, you know, largely never write voiceover. And Goodfellas goes, fuck you. Well, I'm going to write as much voiceover as I possibly can. And he is perfect. He nails it so perfectly. I was thinking about this the other day on the poster, the iconic poster. Some posters, I think, have Paul Sorvino on it as Paulie. But mostly the poster of Goodfellas is the three of them. De Niro, Pesci, and Liotta. And he's the first to go of the three of them. And that just made me sad. But he was an amazing actor. And I'm sure we all have our particular favorites. Oh, God, I've just completely, forgotten Identity. Because he worked with a number of actors. So Copland, he works with Jim Mangold, who of course is directing Indiana Jones 5. Mm-hmm. And then they made, after Copland, they made a really nasty little thriller, really fun, nasty little thriller called Identity. It's a murder mystery thing set in a motel with John Cusack and a really, really great cast. And he's great in that also. So, if you're looking for something that's maybe slightly off the beaten path, then maybe check out Identity. But otherwise, wallow in Goodfellas, wallow in Something Wild, wallow in Copland, wallow in The Many Saints of Newark. Or Operation Dumbo Drop, if you wish to. You can do that as well. And just raise a glass. Whatever's in that glass is entirely up to you, to the great Ray Liotta, who passed away at the age of 67. All right, should we have this week's guest?
Let's
do it. All right, so a couple of years ago, during the pandemic, we were all very, very low and feeling very, very sorry for ourselves. And then a film dropped on Shudder called Host, which was about 56 minutes long. And frankly, if it had been a minute longer, it would not have worked. 56 minutes is a perfect length. Host was a horror film made on the cheap, relative cheap, by the British filmmaker Rob Savage and his co-writers Jed Shepherd and Gemma Hurley. And if you haven't seen it, it's incredible. Basic premise is five girls have a seance over Zoom. A demon gets into the seance and things go horribly awry. It was one of the most effective and terrifying horror films I've seen in a long, long time. And it put Rob Savage on the map. In fact, he and Shepherd and Hurley are back. They moved very, very quickly when that movie was on. In the bloom of their success, they moved on very, very quickly to make another movie, which is similar but different at the same time. And it is another found footage movie, another short one. It's about an hour long. It's called Dashcam, and it stars the podcaster and musician and provocateur, if you will, Annie Hardy, as a version of herself who comes to London in the middle of the pandemic and wreaks havoc in someone's life. And while she's going AWOL, she finds herself picking up an elderly lady who seems to be in the grip of something malevolent, shall we say. And from there, it all goes horribly awry. And the reason the film is called Dashcam is because it's largely shot through Annie Hardy's dashcam, because she does live concerts while she's driving. That's kind of, you know, one of the things that she does in real life through something called Band Car. And it is a rip-roaring, gore-filled, shocking ride. And last week I had the chance to speak to Annie Hardy and her co-star Umar Chadha Patel and Rob Savage, all three of them together. Now, this is a raucous and at times racy interview. So, you know, this interview has been classified 18. Let's just put it that way, shall we? Here we go. Rob, Annie and Umar, do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the director and the stars of Dashcam, Rob Savage, Annie Hardy and Umar Chadha Patel. How the devil are you all?
Very well. How are you, Chris?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I've just seen Dashcam, as I was just saying to you guys off air. And I'm still trying to recover. Not from all the fun bits, but the gore and the jumping and the shrieks and the violence, all that sort of stuff. I'm trying to recover from the credits, which I've never seen anything like it. It's astonishing. So not to spoil things too much for people, the credits of Dashcam involve Annie driving around LA, I presume, Annie?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. And kind of doing what you do in Band Car, which is making up songs with people's names, only it's the crew and the cast of the movie, and it's the most glorious filth.
I remember the disclaimer coming through and being like, Annie's going to rap your name in the credits. Are you okay with that? I was like, by this point, I don't care. Yeah. Let's go. No one is safe.
You can't say no. Otherwise, you're such a puss. And you'll spend the rest of your life wondering what I would have said.
That can haunt you.
Originally, I was doing like cute, nice things. Sorry, I live under the Burbank Airport flight path here. So I was doing like cute ones with that, like pertain, because I remembered everybody's roles and stuff, like and making like little inside jokes. And Rob told me, you know, just be as nasty as you want. Like, okay, I can do that. That's my, you know,
that's second nature.
That's for USP.
Yeah, we there's so many things said about Jason Blum and his various family members.
Oh my god.
We need to destroy that footage because none of us would ever work again. We'd be found floating dead in a pool.
But if Jason Blum, of course, he's famously parsimonious. I mean, his movies cost no more than $5 million. So I have to think if Jason Blum were to have you killed, he wouldn't hire a hitman. He'd try and do it himself.
Yeah.
Get a hammer out.
That'd be a great movie.
It would be.
Do you think he'd be a good hitman, Jason Blum? Do you think he'd be efficient?
He's quite a high profile, but yeah.
Yeah, I reckon so.
He's definitely seen enough weird movies to get the inspiration to do it that he could probably get away with it.
But listen, Rob, where did that idea come from to have the credits? Yeah.
Originally, it was like to show, you know, there's lots of special effects in the movie, but I wanted people to see that the one thing that wasn't a special effect was Annie and her like her spontaneous wit, and that she actually does this. She drives around and makes these incredible like 20 minute long continuous raps. And so the original idea was that it would be like a 10 minute single take of her rapping the credits in real time. And I went to LA and me and Annie drove around, and Annie like stayed up all night to get in this weird frazzled headspace and did this incredible like 8 minute long take. That's like most of what you see in the film is that, because I just wanted people to see, like, there's no strings. It's just, this is what it is. And then Jason saw it and was like, this is the best part of the movie. You've got to make this even longer. And I don't know if we did it on purpose or not out of fear, but we didn't sing anything about Jason Blum on the first one. He was like, I want Annie to sing my name. He looked me in the eyes and said, she needs to sing my name.
Amazing. So you went back and did reshoots.
Just drove around for days on end.
After shooting. Fashion. Amazing. Amar, what did Annie sing about you? I can't quite remember. Was it palatable?
She, you were pretty kind to me. You definitely I think you dropped the word willow in there, didn't you?
I said, I'm going to tell you what, there's a willow in your butt.
Yeah. Well, obviously a lot of chat about my butt generally in the film, but But yeah, you dropped the Willow bomb before it was officially announced. So
you could have got me. The movie hadn't come out officially, so it doesn't really count.
Disney's that's true. That's true. Planning. Yeah, we thought it was going to come out earlier and that you were going to get me murdered by Disney.
There's still time.
There's still time.
Yeah.
I find it awfully suspicious that both of y'all, Rob and Emma, are both working for Disney right now.
I think everyone works for Disney.
I guess technically, now that Fox is owned by Disney, or right? Not the other way around.
Yeah.
No, I'm not talking shit. I love Disney.
So do I, and not because I'm contracted to say it.
Me too. Disney.
I've been to Disneyland.
I have not, so I need to do that.
How was it? How was Disneyland, Annie? What was your last time? When was the last time you were there?
Oh, the last time I went was not so great. I think my boyfriend at the time broke up with me at Disneyland, which is like, do that here.
What a choice. Okay?
This is not the place for that. This is like Disneyland, man.
That's one step below the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
So this was a deliberate thing that he had done. He'd planned this clearly to take you to Disneyland, then dump you, or was it the spur of the moment?
It wasn't premeditated. He was just like an idiot. You know, I was 19. It was like the year 2000. So, yeah. Okay.
All right.
Rob, were you even born yet?
2000. You were 8 years old. No, I was still a fetus then.
Yeah.
No. The year 2000, Rob, it was a year that took place about 22 years ago. It was glorious.
It was an absolute riot.
The beginning of the countdown of 5 years left before the world starts to turn.
Well, I'm so glad that I've got the three of you here as well, because credits aside, you know, I've read up about how you made this movie, and it is such a unique, intense, improvisational experience where the three of you really worked very, very, very closely together. And I just wanted to get you, you know, to ask you about that and what that was like.
Well, it was, I mean, the film was built around Annie and Bancar, which she really does. And like, I didn't actually meet Annie until about 2 weeks before the film started. I'd Zoomed with her a couple of times and I'd watched a bunch of Bancar. But, you know, we went into this pretty fast after Host. We shot this in 2020, winter of 2020, same year we made Host. And, you know, the only reason I kind of confidently went into doing another improvised movie is because I saw Bancar and I was like, oh, Annie can totally carry us on this film. You know, she's got such a kind of spontaneity and wit about her that that I can really lean on her for the improv. And then Emma was... I'm a friend of all the Host crew. So we kind of had always wanted to do something together. And then off the back of Host, you know, we got this opportunity to do another movie and we kind of built it around the idea of like Emma and Annie in a car together. Mm. And that's to say really that like I only met Annie a couple of weeks before shooting. And so she was kind of stepping into this role that we'd written for her. It wasn't really based in knowing her at all. So Annie was kind of coming in and we were figuring each other out as we made the film and figuring out the whole process. And also it was the first time we'd been in the same room as other people for months and months and months. So it was a very bizarre time.
Annie, what made you say yes to this? This is a fairly wild pitch.
It is. Well, my friend Jed Shepard, one of the writers on the film, had been saying for years, like, I want to make a Bancar horror film. And I thought he was just like full of shit, like everybody else who says that they want to do something, you know, like, oh, I have an idea that's never going to come to fruition. And then shockingly, all of a sudden, I'm like on a Zoom call with him and Rob. And I'm like, oh, this still isn't going to happen, you know, and because it's like it is kind of unthinkable to just have someone call you one day like, hey, we're going to make a horror film. You're the main character. And it's based on kind of your life, but kind of not really. And I don't know. It was weird. And then Rob had me do this like live Periscope as often as I possibly could to this private channel for him to watch and get a better idea.
That sounds sordid.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does, yeah.
I had to do mine naked.
Yeah. But it was clear that like, you know, I almost backed out twice, full disclosure, because I was like, man, these people are going to make me seem like a piece of shit. Like, this kind of sucks. Like, You know, like, I don't want to be using my name and then feel like a piece of shit and all these idiots of the world have to like discern this gray area between reality and, you know, fiction. But then, you know, Rob just basically coerced me. And
well, I think I called you up and I was like, Annie, everyone in this movie is a piece of shit. Umba's a piece of shit.
Absolutely.
Angela's a piece of shit. Like, I think that's the truth. That's definitely my taste, is to have a movie and populate it with people who are all totally awful.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, but that said, nobody afterwards, like on Twitter, said like Uma should die. You know, nobody said Angela should die. Nobody thought Angela was a real demon, even. You know, but it's like with me, they're like, hey, something about this is like real. You know,
I just needed a job.
Yeah, and the nudity, which
never made it to the film, so I don't really know why I did it. I mean, Host was remarkable, and I had this glorious, unique opportunity to watch it happen as it was coming to life through a group of friends, and then not be part of it, and so observe it from afar and see it happening, because I was shooting in Europe at the time when it came out, and just saw this thing come to life. So I immediately wanted to work with Rob and Jed and Gemma and the whole team. And then I have been a director and a production designer in my past as well, and a musician. And just the idea of improvising a film and self-shooting it to a degree, because it was live streamed on a phone, just felt like the most exciting challenge for any performer.
These guys really like are the cinematographers and the production.
I forget about that sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of the joy of it was that often on the ground it could really only be myself, Annie, Rob, and Doug, our producer, and then Ben running around like a blue ass fly with a boom stick, trying as hard as possible not to be in the shot that we would always find him. It was great. Everyone would just hit the deck and we just start spinning around wherever we were, and no one was safe because everything was fair game. It was
the only people we didn't get in the shots were each other.
Yeah, most of the
time. I'm like very tall and I'm like average. And so it would always be like.
Yeah, the bigger challenge for me was getting myself out of frame, because I feel like that's my job. And Rob would just come back and be like, no, it's good tape, but I'm seeing too much of you. I was like,
isn't that much?
Yeah, he is like, no, just crop your face out. Just get like half your chin.
Comes in.
Yeah, make it more lower. Yeah, lower, down,
from
down.
The waist down only.
Yeah, yeah. If it was up to me, that would be the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an utterly unique experience. I've never heard of a film being done like that and getting the chance to do it like that. I don't think people will really appreciate the amount of work that went into making it seem completely on the fly, and because it was self-shot by us, but the rigs and some of the stuff we achieved and these guys did is mind-blowing.
There's probably a reason that movies aren't made like that.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, because it's so hard.
Yeah, it's ridiculously complex, and then you guys have to you're improvising as well in the moment, and then the camera work is frenetic at times but also has to be precise. So, you know, you have to reveal things at the right moment and make it not seem like you're setting it up. That's fucking difficult. How did you do that? Was it just tons and tons of takes, or are you just naturally amazing at that sort of stuff?
We're just naturally amazing.
Yeah.
The liar. Rob has to do so many takes. And I feel like I'm like a first take Jake.
Yeah, me too, actually.
It's always the best. It's all downhill from there.
No. The great thing about Annie is that you can't, like, if you do take one, you're like, yeah, do the same thing, but just tweak this one little thing. You can't do, like, every single take Annie does would be totally different. She'd be interested in a different thing. You'd improvise a totally different thing. So, like, I'd have to do 20 takes because I would never know what you'd say on the next one, and it might be old, and usually it was.
Yeah.
The curse of being so unique. But like also if we were doing it regular movie style, like I would probably be terrible at something like that because like I don't really understand the direction that Rob's giving me. Like in some ways I'm like I have a hyper like a mind that like moves in a way that other people's doesn't. And then when I have to do understand normal things or like make the bed in the morning, you know, it's just like it's really difficult for me. So
what sort of direction was he giving you, Annie?
I can't remember now at this point, but it would be like, just like I would have to remember this like choreography of like, this is going to happen. And then you do this. And then the camera, a lot of camera whipping needed to happen so that Rob could put hidden cuts.
Hidden cuts. A lot of, there was a lot of hidden cut, but like not making it look like a hidden cut.
Yeah. Right. But I think you're underselling yourself, because I think actually there's a few scenes that you just had to do one thing and you weren't able to lean on dick jokes, and like you were just amazing. Like the scene where you're hiding under in the water tunnel and you have to do the Blair Witch moment where you have a little breakdown. Like we did, that was like a proper scene.
Though. There was no acting required because I was like low key being tortured.
I mean, I feel the same.
It was 1 a.m. in a sewer in Norfolk or something like that. And it's like, and for this scene where I crawl out of the river, it's like it was snowing and all my clothes were wet. And so I was really crying. And like in the mirror maze, like Rob was hitting with.
Oh, yeah, that was terrifying.
And I was really scared. So it's like, And when we're in the backseat of the car and Angela's doing this
thing. Oh my God, that was chaos.
That was chaos. And I was actually scared and really thought we were getting in a car accident.
Yeah.
Nobody told me.
Because there was a funny guy who the car was being driven by a little man on the top of the car in a little pod. And you would just forget that there was a man controlling the car. And I would just be swerving left, right, and center.
I don't think I told you guys that they were going to head right for the other car and just swerve out of the way at the last minute.
You didn't tell us that at all. No, we didn't think there was going to be another car. There were a lot of those cheeky little surprises, Rob. I mean, my character loses a shoe pretty early on in the film. So for the most part of 2 months, I was shoeless in like December. And they would have to keep rushing me off of, I mean, I'd say set, but I'm talking a field. Like we'd be shooting in the middle of Suffolk at like 1 a.m. and they'd have to rush me into a tent with heaters because my foot would just be steaming. That was cold.
That was Doug's idea to have you take the sock off. He was like, wouldn't it be funny if I'm stood on a hypodermic needle? And I was like, that would be funny.
Thanks, Doug.
But it went in the movie.
Well, Doug's got COVID right now, so I guess we know
karma. Doug's on him.
So karma has finally caught up with him, is that what you're saying?
Again, he gave me COVID at London Film Fest, coughed directly into my face.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah, shit.
What with forethought and malice, or was it an accident?
No, it was actually the day after London Film Fest, and then he did a dry cough. We were at his house, and he dry coughed. Like right into my face. And I said, don't cough on me with that COVID cough, man. And sure enough, 3 days later, the death had settled in on me.
Yeah.
Right after Rob and I went to Sitges in Spain and probably infected half the country. Sorry, we tested.
We were negative though.
Yeah. That's how it gets you. But Annie, have you got the bug, not the COVID bug, but the filmmaking bug?
Oh.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, I like doing it. I think this was such a unique opportunity. I mean, look, I've been in a couple movies before. I was in the Spike Jonze short film and this other movie, The Icarus Line Must Die. And all of them I'm playing myself. So I get that I have a certain character acting thing. But I can't imagine, like, you know, dressing up in a Renaissance piece. You know, and like, you know, I can't imagine doing that. Would I do dash cam too? Yes, I would do that for sure.
Wow. Despite the torture and the cold and the Englishness?
Be tortured. So it works out really well. It's like a S&M dungeon on wheels for 3 months in England. It's like, bring it on. That's my resting state, is being tortured by British people.
That's such a great tagline. An S&M dungeon on wheels.
Yeah. That's the ideal immersive theatre experience.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. And obviously, Robin and Amar, you're pretty busy working on more things and very, very exciting things. Rob, what's the latest on The Boogeyman?
We've wrapped. We're editing. It looks like a movie. It's going to be a good movie, I think. yeah, I think I didn't fuck it up. I think it's going to be really good. We had like such an amazing crew and cast, and it's very, very different from Dashcam, just as Dashcam is very different from Host. So it's hopefully going to surprise people.
Yeah, and presumably not 100% faithful to the short story, which is very short.
We've kind of built the mythology out in a way that what can I say without getting assassinated? We built the mythology out in our own way, but King read the script, was really positive about it, is in full support. So long as I'm fucked up the shooting a bit, I think we've got a good movie.
That's the dream. If Stephen King is in support of anything you do, that's the dream.
Yeah, absolutely. And Amar, you've shot Willow. Willow is ready to go.
Yeah, should be a trailer dropping any moment. Teaser trailer. It's right up my butt. And I just did Gareth Edwards' new feature in Thailand, which is all kinds of crazy. The world is not ready for that. Similarly to Dashcam, the shooting star, I'm going to say. Yeah, but like Gareth's style. I mean, I can't say too much, but yeah. He's an actor's director for sure. And we were just running around Thailand with cameras, tiny cameras, big lenses, shooting all sorts of chaos. So yeah, exciting stuff coming.
I love Gareth Edwards. I cannot wait to see that movie. Does that movie, and in fact, does the Boogeyman finish with someone rapping your names for 6 minutes?
Yeah, that's I'll do it. Now.
I'm available for hire.
Annie, seriously, you should do this for every fucking movie that comes out from now on.
I kind of agree, man.
Yeah.
I would love to.
Because then we all have to sit through a credit sequence now because of some sort of post-credits trailer. Might as well make them really fun.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. Stick it on a Marvel movie with the most unspeakable filth. I would love to
see Annie wrap the credits of a Marvel film in a way that would be acceptable. That would be really unique.
Steven Spielberg. The things I could rhyme with that name.
I'm going to let you guys go. It's been an absolute pleasure. But I think we should stop before we get ourselves killed.
Yeah, good idea.
Thanks, amazing. Thanks very much. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so that was Rob Savage, Umar Jadda Patel, and Annie Hardy. And Dashcam is out, well, now, by the time you listen to it. There was a big controversy about whether it was banned by Vue. Yeah. We'll get out in a second because we're about to lose one of our number.
You are, yes. I have a hard out and I need to go upstairs and finish some stuff before I go. So I am going to
this
be
all
away.
The Queen's fault.
But I give Bergman Island 5 Bergmans. So that's
five
great.
5 Bergmans out of how many?
Out of 5. 5 Bergmans out of 5. I give men...
Give a 5
2.5 men. And,
2.5 men?
Yeah.
Men,
4 dash cams. There you go.
Okay, that's James Webb saying he hasn't seen any of them.
I don't know what you mean. I've seen all of these films.
Oh, boy.
You will never know. Bye.
Bye, James. Happy Queen Day. Well, Amon, it's just you and me.
Oh, boy.
Alone at last.
I'm just going to move to that side of the table.
You can't escape me. You can't win, Darth.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dashcam. So there was this brief controversy that flared today, where Rob Savage said on Twitter that it seemed that the Vue cinema chain, had banned Dashcam. Were not showing Dashcam in any of their cinemas, and the reason seemed to be that they were disagreeing with the film's content, not in terms of its gore and whatnot, but in terms of the things that Annie Hardy. Who in the film is an exaggerated version of herself and says and does things that some people might find unconscionable. But that doesn't seem to be the case. So now fewer are saying the reason we're not showing Dashcam is because it just the numbers didn't quite work out for us.
Yeah. Now I'm glad that has changed. Filmmakers should feel free to sort of, you know, put their work on screen and have that work be shown as it was intended without any sort of restrictions on it. So I'm glad that that was sorted out. That being said, let's talk about Dashcam because, well, we'll get into it, but...
We should. Now would be a good time.
I meant we'll get into it in terms of what I think about the film.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But in terms of what the film is actually about, it follows Annie Hardy, as you say, who is an LA musician fleeing lockdown, and she wants to visit a former bandmate in England. and that visit complications arise because she is not the best person to live with, to put it mildly. She angers her former bandmate's girlfriend, he endangers his job, and then things take a turn for the worst when she accepts some money to drive a stranger to a different address. This stranger is ill, and then it's revealed that the stranger has a lot more weird stuff going on with her, and that is all I will say about that. I will say this, there are some really cool stylistic things here, especially when the shaky cam, there's a lot of shaky cam in this movie, but there are times when they slow that down, and there's a lot of really meticulously crafted shots throughout this movie that are really striking and really stick in your mind. So I enjoyed that. I have to praise the commitment of Annie Hardy in terms of committing to the bit, although, as you say, given that it's a version of herself, there's that question as well of how much of that is commitment, how much of that is just her. But given that, for me, the character, it was a little hard to sort of spend 1 hour with her because I did find her a lot grating all the way through. I found that a bit repetitive. And yeah, this movie was, even though it was an hour long, I felt it was, watching it, it felt a little bit longer to me. I kind of couldn't wait for it to end. I was not a big fan.
Okay, interesting. Did you like Host?
I did like Host. We had that very funny spoiler special because, as you know, I don't do well with horror, and there was a lot of freaky stuff in that movie. I thought that was really effective, and that was the thing that had me going to this one with, even though it was another horror movie, it was a guy who did Host, let's see what he's got. And with this, I didn't even find it that scary, to be honest. Did you?
It's an interesting film, this one. I kind of agree that it's not as scary as Host. What's interesting about it is I don't think it's meant to be. I think this is a very interesting exercise at a point in Rob Savage's career where he can experiment with stuff, where he can experiment with things like running time and audience complicity and audience reactions to things. And this is, you know, if Host took a very kind of traditional approach with horror, which is, here are your characters, you like these characters, these are likable, relatable characters for the most part. And this is a very similar movie in that nothing happens for the first 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Host, in that it's all set up. And then once the shit starts hitting the fan, that fan gets turned to high speed very, very quickly, and then shit's everywhere. Not the greatest metaphor, but I'm going with it. The interesting thing here is that this is a deliberate attempt to put the audience through the ringer with a character that is testing.
To put it mildly.
I think it works in terms of it being a roller coaster ride, more of a roller coaster ride. I mean, it obviously moves more just by its very nature. It moves more than Host did. I don't think it's quite as successful as Host. I don't think it's as scary as Host, but I think that's deliberate. I think it's more about this being an onslaught of lots of loud noises and things leaping at you out of the frame. I think if this were a $30 million movie or a $50 million movie, then I don't think that he's taking the risks that he does with the lead character here. But I'm very, very excited to see where he goes next. And I'm excited to talk about this because we're doing a spoiler special in this with Rob Savage and with the co-writers, Jemma Hurley and Jed Shepherd. And there's a lot to talk about.
Honestly, I'm excited to hear what they have to say. I think I'll find their answers very, very interesting, given the provocative nature of what they're trying to go for here. But yeah, watching it this first time out didn't work for me.
Well, Amon, we didn't agree with you as a magazine, and we gave this one 4 stars. We applauded the filmmaking technique and the bravura on display with this one. 4 stars then for Rob Savage's dash cam. There is another horror film out this week, and it is called Men. Men. And this is the movie that Rory Kinnear was on last week's podcast, interviewed so expertly by Amon.
Oh,
come on now. You paid me to say that. And this is the Alex Garland film, written and directed by Alex Garland, of course, of Annihilation and Ex Machina. And he was the writer of Dread. Great, great film.
Yes.
And, genius level writer and increasingly accomplished director. And this stars Jesse Buckley as A woman who has suffered a recent trauma in her life and relocates to a place where, at least to her and our perception, every man she meets has Rory Kinnear's face. Now, I haven't seen this one yet. I am going to go to a screening of this immediately afterwards. But Amon has seen it. And a week later, are you still coming to terms with it? What's happening here?
Still coming to terms with it is probably the best way to describe it. But I will say this, you know, Rory Kinnear and Jesse Buckley are fantastic. These are two names where you hear them on the cast, it's like, okay, I'm immediately interested because they are that good. And Rory Kinnear, this is a dream role for an actor getting to play all of these characters and really sort of be a chameleon and add to the archetypes of these characters, because they are archetypes. They are all people who are avatars of toxic masculinity and who all sort of interact with Jesse Buckley's character in different ways. But Rory Kinnear is able to put meat on the bone with each of these archetypes in a really, really impressive way. And Jesse Buckley, she's just so magnetic as Harper all the way through this film. So I like that. And some of the horror imagery in this film is just, I mean, it'll mess you up. Without getting into spoilers, the last 20 or so minutes of this film, I wish there was a camera on my face so I could watch it back and just see what faces I was making, because I was like, what in the actual hell am I watching? I can't wait to discuss this with you, Chris, once you've seen it. Yeah, what it all leads up to, I'm still coming to terms with it. I feel like there's many things that the film kind of wants to say, but I'm unsure how it's trying to say it. I think it's in some ways about trauma, it's in some ways about men and how they interact with women, and it's in some ways about grief as well, especially when it comes to Jesse Buckley's character. We see the trauma that she goes through early on in the film, and that sort of plays a role and is something that she comes back to at multiple points all the way through the film. So yeah, it's a bit of a weird one, this. Alex Garland, I should probably say, I admire the sort of swings he takes, but I haven't sort of fallen for them all of the time. I was not part of the Annihilation loving. I know there was a big loving amongst critics. Ex Machina is a film that I got along with a little bit more in comparison to that. I'm a big fan of Dredd. This is probably his biggest, weirdest swing in some respects, and you have to admire that to a point. But in terms of me fully falling in love with it and getting it on first time out, that is still, I'm not there yet. I'll happily admit that. But I will say, again, given the performances, given what I've read up about it since, I'm intrigued to go into it again with that knowledge and see how it plays for me.
All right. Interesting. You think Rory Kinnear is chameleonic? You have no idea, because he actually plays Jesse Buckley as well.
He's really great. I would not be surprised, honestly.
He is really, really, really great. We gave this one 3 stars. We gave this one 3 stars. 3 stars then for Alex Garland's Men. But as we always say in the podcast, that is a recommendation.
I see what you did there.
I know. So do I. I have to live with it now. Last but not least this week, we have Bergman Island, which is the latest film from Mia Hansen-Love, and takes us to, indeed, Bergman Island. Foro, I believe is how you pronounce it. Swedish listeners are probably going to be listening, you know, throwing things at the pod device of choice.
We apologize.
The gentleman who advised me a couple of weeks ago that Alexander Skarsgård is actually pronounced Skorsgård, and then you hear the island Faro. That's how you pronounce it if you say it. You know, if you read it as is written, Faro. I would pronounce that Faro or Faro, but if you hear it in the movie, then they actually pronounce it Foro. So. That's cool because of the Swedish pronunciation and whatnot. So this is the island which Ingmar Bergman, the great Ingmar Bergman, lived and worked and, you know, made many of his greatest movies whilst he was there. And this is the story of a married couple, a filmmaker couple, played by Tim Roth, and Vicky Creeps, who go to this island for a sort of filmmaker's immersive workshop / masterclass / get away from it all, so she can write a screenplay for their next movie. He's also writing the screenplay for the next movie. There are cracks that begin to appear in their marriage, scenes from a marriage, if you will. and there are other ways, other things that develop, including a sort of intervention of fantasy into reality, a film within the film, if you will. So Amon, what did you make of this one?
Yeah, I really loved that film within a film element. And I really like this film as a whole. The performances are fantastic. I love the marital tension that Tim Roth and Vicky Creeps sort of showcase here. I love that they never really raise their voice, but you can feel the tension all the way through. I love as well, being a writer myself, the fact that so much of that tension is rooted in writer's block and, you know, kind of, you know, help
never me. Never had it, mate. Knock it out.
I'm sure.
Hack
I'm sure.
it out, more like.
A lot of that stuff felt very relatable to me. Mm. So that was good. And then that film within a film structure gives us Mia Wasikowska and Anders Danielsson Lee, who impressed me so much with his work on The Worst Person in the World, which this would make a very good double bill. Would actually think it make a really good triple bill with The Souvenir Part 2 as well. Because these are all films about women sort of finding their role and finding their place, finding their confidence in their work life and in life in general. And I really, really like that. All of that came through very, very well. Also, I wish Ben was here for this as well. Probably the best use of ABBA in the film since Mamma Mia. Would you agree? It's a really great scene.
I would agree, yes.
So yeah.
Yes.
I will say, like, I'm not the biggest Ingmar Bergman fan, so I'm sure people who are will take even more from this film. Because there's a lot that's to do with that. They go on this retreat and go to places that he visited and that he owned in order to sort of help unlock that writer's block and, you know, in order to help them with their screenplays. So if you are a fan of Ingmar Bergman, you'll probably take, you know, more from scenes like that. But even without having that, I did really enjoy this film.
Yes, I did as well. Very much so. And, you know, it's interesting that I think in the Vicky Creeps character, it does present a counter argument to anyone who thinks that, you know, maybe it's just Mia Hansen-Love kind of just covering her bases a little bit and having to have a character who doesn't believe that Ingmar Bergman's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But, you know, that's certainly the Vicky Creeps' character. Chris, not me, is someone who doesn't worship at his altar, which I thought was interesting. Whereas Tim Roth's Tony very much is. And we get to see little excerpts from Cries and Whispers and, you know, they actually shot on the island and they shot around his home, which is basically now, I believe, almost like a National Trust property or the Swedish equivalent of a National Trust property.
We should also mention that Tim Roth is a filmmaker in this who interacts with a lot of film nerds.
Yes.
And that aspect is, I wouldn't say all the way relatable, but I know some of those types, shall we say.
Absolutely. But yes, it's so, you know, whether you're a fan of Bergman or not, I think there's a lot here to enjoy and a lot to appreciate. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we will be back to a full complement-ish. Helen will be off for another week or so, but we'll probably have four people in the room. And
cool.
I'm hoping that, you know, they'll stay the course with the entire podcast rather than just leaving halfway through.
Or maybe even watch the films. Who knows?
Well, you're asking a lot from James. That is asking an awful lot of him. You know, baby steps. Anyway, join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Bryce Dallas Howard.
Woo.
Bryce Dallas Howard, star of Jurassic World Dominion, the third film in the Jurassic World trilogy, which brings that franchise, for now, to an end. Or does it? Etc., etc., etc. And we'll also be joined by, I hope, the interview hasn't happened yet, but we think it's going to happen next week, by the star of Swan Song, not to be confused with the 14 other movies called Swan Song that were released over the last few years. This is the legendary king of independent cinema, Udo Kier. Very, very excited about that one as well. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's time to say goodbye to my one colleague of such lethal cunning.
I stayed the course.
Thank you for staying the course, Amon Woman. I mean, I could do this by myself, but I don't think it would be anywhere near as compelling. Amon Woman, goodbye, sir.
Peace.
Peace be unto you, my friend. And it is goodbye from me as well. I am off to, you know, keep half an eye on the Queen's Jubilee celebrations. There's a big old party at Buckingham Palace with some of the biggest names in the world of entertainment. And my hope, my fervent hope, is that they find room for Enrico Palazzo. That would be amazing. Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo! Bring it home, my friend. Bring it home. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week. Bye.